hopefully wrapping up today. We're kind of towards the end. If you've got your hand out, we're about on around page 10 or 11. If you want to kind of flip there, we've talked about different positions that a Christian can have towards warfare, and we were just kind of beginning to expound upon what are some principles that that would apply to a Christian or a believer who's seeking to be obedient to God, and asking, how can I be involved in any way? What are my clear boundaries in terms of what would be just in terms of involvement in warfare, and what would be unjust? Okay. So, if you want to look there at page 11, we'll kind of just review the ones we ended on last time. Right. So, we had gone through maybe the first four. Okay. So, what was the first one?
Defensive, but not aggressive.
Yeah. So, is it a just war, right? And so, is there a just cause, .. right? Is this a defensive or aggressive? And so, oftentimes, as we kind of look through that, we're asking ourselves, can I or should I be involved in this war in any fashion? And so, aggressive wars in terms of, for example, I think, invading, attacking in order for military conquest, that'd be an aggressive war, an unjust war. That last line there, in this case, the nation could act as a third party defending the oppressed, right? Defending the oppressed from aggression. So it could be either you're the ones who've been invaded and your nation is being conquered. Could you could it be a just cause in terms of defending your citizens, your family, the people that are living in the country? Okay. All right, so you have the second one. It's just cause, and what's the second one?
Intent.
Yeah, just intent. And so those are pretty closely related, but you could maybe have some overlap, or maybe there is an opportunity where there's a nation that is invaded, or your nation is invaded, and you have a just cause to participate in warfare, but in order for you to participate in that, there's all sorts of different motivations that you could have. So what would be maybe some wrong motivations you could have, even if it was a just cause?
To the victor goes the spoils.
Right, yeah. So maybe you're going to defend this nation, but that nation also happens to have a lot of resources. Yeah. Anything else? Other unjust?
Total annihilation.
Yeah.
We're just going to wipe them out.
Yeah. We're just waiting for the opportunity. Yeah. They've kind of awoken the sleeping giant, and we're going to crush them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think three, this is a tough one, right? So what was the third one? Last what?
Last resort.
Last resort. And so there is a lot of talk, just in doing some study, about how you kind of have to walk this line. And if you look back at some of the presuppositions, that evil cannot be avoided. When you're evaluating warfare and looking at enemies or nations or leaders, when you look at using all other means of working with, there's the question of at what point do you run out? When have you reached that last resort? How much can you give? How much can you sacrifice. So that's kind of a tough question to answer. I think there's this resistance that at some point you have to realize, okay, we've tried this, didn't work, we've tried this, it didn't work. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then I think the one we ended on last time was formal declaration, properly constituted and authorized. Formal declaration by the proper body. And so why is that important, and why is that kind of a loving thing? We talked about that a little bit. Why is it a loving thing to actually declare war?
Clarity. You know, I mean, there's not a question of what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, I mean, define mission intent.
Mm-hmm. And so what options does that give you that maybe you wouldn't have had or wouldn't have made certain decisions if you haven't declared war?
It gives the civilians a chance to consider what side will we be on.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of gives everybody an out.
Mm-hmm.
And are we going to, let's say, like one example would be Hamas right now.
Mm-hmm.
Would the Palestinians support Hamas and side with Israel against Hamas?
Mm-hmm.
The declaration of war kind of clarifies the issue for them so
yeah.
that the bystanders can really decide what... you know, who they want to back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for believers and also non-believers, there are many people who, when their country enters into war, they flee because they don't want to be involved in that warfare. They know that it's, or maybe their warfare has already begun and they've been seeking to not be a part of that war. And so it gives people a chance to know, hey, we're going to be attacked, we're going to be invaded, we're going to be drawn into the military. In almost every country, there are those citizens, believers and unbelievers both, that don't want to be a part of that war. And so once that war is declared, it gives people kind of that warning of whether or not they want to be involved in that.
I think it holds you accountable. The U.S. has a history of fighting a shadow war in Latin America and places like Honduras.
Mm-hmm.
And we have not been held accountable for our actions. We instituted their militarized government. We helped them organize a coup. And we haven't been held accountable for it, and I doubt we ever will be. And it's because we never officially declared war.
Mm-hmm.
We just funded everything and gave them weapons and gave them specialized military training and lent them a couple,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, squads, I guess, of operatives.
Yeah.
And so when you declare war on somebody, it's you making yourself, in at least giving yourself the opportunity to be held accountable
mm-hmm.
by other nations. Because when you don't declare that you're engaging in war,
mm-hmm.
it's really, really difficult to accuse you of doing things you should not have done.
Yeah.
Because you can always just say, oh, that wasn't really us. That was, mm-hmm. That was people acting outside of our control.
Yeah, there's a certain sense when we talk about Christians in warfare where there's that sense of like, what are you? How transparent are you going to be? Right? And like, once you enter into warfare, then it's like you don't want to lay the battle plans out in front of them, but at least you know who your enemy is in that sense. So, I think. Tanner, you kind of hit this a little bit. Number five, the objectives must be limited. I think that when you think about what is your goal, right? And so really in just war, our goal is peace. Our goal is peace and protection and the preservation of life. And so when you have nations or leaders or people who are acting in such a way that there's no way to restrain them from violence other than warfare. You're entering in that, but things like unconditional surrender or total destruction, that would be a key, sign that that would be an unjust war. Let's just nuke everybody, right? Just wipe them off the planet, type of thing. And so it'd be more of a restraint on the sign of the size of the aggressor. Okay, proportionate. Okay, six would be. It needs to be proportionate. And what was it again? Limited. So minimize the suffering of our enemies. Loving our enemies means that we restrain them from evil. It also mandates that we minimize their suffering, thus we do not use nuclear weapons when conventional warfare will do. This, again, can be challenging. I think I talked with Floyd, who talked about how, when we talked about the dropping of the atomic bomb, there was a lot of like calculus going on between the number of lives, that which one is going to cause more deaths and which one is going to save more lives in terms of the how long warfare would need to continue before there would be an end to the war. Troops on both sides. There was also the issue of number seven here, non-combatants must be protected and military operations must demonstrate the highest possible degree of discrimination. And so to discriminate between civilians and those involved in the warfare. So again, on one side you have an argument that this show of force was going to end the war, so it would end the loss of life on both sides. But on the other side, you've got this idea of are we showing any discrimination here, or are we just destroying both civilians and military at the same time? So not an easy decision.
Do you think Hiroshima and Nagasaki was just a just action?
Well, not being the history buff, I know I've talked about it some with my grandfather, with my wife's grandfather, that kind of were there, and my Chris's grandpa, they had bombed most of, there had been bombing and bombing and bombing, and so his thoughts were, he didn't really understand why they did it, because everything was virtually destroyed, in a sense that all their military, it was just, and they were continuing to fight, to not surrender. And so that was kind of the key question, is what, if anything, kind of the mindset and the culture was that no, every person has to die, no one's going to surrender, there's no such thing. And so that's kind of the tough question, is what would it, and it's hard to measure sometimes looking at history, because we really don't ever have the alternate, you don't really know what would have happened and how
is
long.
Is that, I don't know history really be real well either, is that the only atomic bomb dropped on
those two,
on
yeah.
People. On people.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the only use. And then up to then, it's just, after that, it's just
threats.
Building and building.
So I'm not a huge history buff, but I do like history.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just that they weren't surrendering, it was the sheer number of islands that they were entrenched on.
Mm-hmm.
And every time American forces tried to take one island, it was a slaughter one way or another.
Yeah.
And they had dozens, if not hundreds, of islands, all with forces holed up there, all who were going to fight to the death.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah.
I don't think the dropping of the bomb. I don't think ultimately we will ever know if it was justifiable or not. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I guess when we talk to God, we can ask.
Yeah.
I think in some way it will always be unjustifiable,
mm-hmm.
and in some way will always be justifiable. But Nagasaki and Hiroshima were bases of military intelligence
mm-hmm.
for the Japanese, as far as I remember, and America warned civilians multiple times, I think. Like, they warned the Japanese government, we are going to bomb you, get people out of there, mm-hmm. and they were replied to with derision. Mm-hmm. They were laughed at by the Japanese, like, command. And
did
so
they drop flyers, too?
They dropped flyers, they gave warnings, and then they gave every opportunity. And again, I'm not saying that excuses it. I'm just saying, mm-hmm. I think on some level, we'll never be able to truly justify it.
Mm-hmm.
And on another level, we'll never be able to truly say it was completely unjustified.
Yeah.
And then I think maybe a little bit, when you think about the entrenchment, it kind of talks about number 8 is like, if you at some point don't believe really there's any hope for success, that's an unjust warfare. So if they believe that there's no way we're going to go in and invade every island and successfully wipe, you know, like with the manpower that we had available, you don't want to wage a war that you really don't believe there's any possible way of winning or coming to some sort of success. And so there has to be a sense in which you have an idea of this is what we're wanting to do to end this war. There has to be a clear way of defining, okay, we're going to war so that we can accomplish this. We have clear hopes, and it looks like it is a possible end that we could be reached.
I think that's one of the main reasons why the Vietnam War was so terrible, was because, like, it just wasn't.
When is it going to end?
Yeah, I think when you get to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there were a bunch of factors that made it a pretty complicated decision, namely that the Russians were going to enter the war in a matter of weeks, and Japan probably was holding out to see if they can play Russia and the U.S. against each other to get a more favorable terms of peace. And there was concern that the Iron Curtain was falling on Europe. Japan could be subdivided in
mm-hmm.
some way. They wouldn't accept an unconditional surrender. So I think it would be very difficult to defend the atomic bomb because of the terms of surrender that the U.S. wanted. They wanted a truly unconditional surrender
mm-hmm.
when.
Yeah.
So there were some pragmatic
mm-hmm.
concerns. And I think dropping one bomb is one thing, dropping two is another.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they had to do another one a few days later.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's a controversial decision.
Mm-hmm.
I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was real easy for the guys on the front. They were looking at millions of casualties.
Yeah.
Like we talked about, to justify the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't know about, maybe they didn't know about the Russians and the politics of it.
Yeah.
But for them, yeah.
But to them, like my dad, that was serving in the Pacific at the time, they were going to, if they invaded China, Japan, they were even teaching kids how to sharpen sticks to fight to the death.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, the casualties America would face was one of the reasons, one of the reasons they chose to drop the bomb. And you have to remember that their emperor was their god.
Mm-hmm.
So we got around it by letting them keep the emperor. And that's what really ended the war, is dropping the two bombs and letting them keep the emperor.
Yeah.
But they had a trial afterward, just like Nuremberg. Tojo and some of the guys that had instrumented the war were put to death.
Hmm.
What governing agency leads those trials?
It's
hard to say because it's like a combination of, you know, nations and
mm-hmm.
representatives, and so I think, you know, when you think about you know, God ruling over the nations. You know, each of those has their own governments. And so we kind of talked about that structure is like, you have all the way down through citizens and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of at each of those levels, you know, you're called to submit to that authority, but at times you have to disobey that authority when it comes to higher authority. So it's like, it takes other nations, it's like, are one of the few things that can exercise authority over any kind of sovereign nation itself. So sometimes we talked about a little bit how, would there be just aspects of the American Revolution, that war,
mm-hmm.
the Civil War of like citizens against its own government or governments against other governments, and so that that principle of submitting to authority and at the same time submitting to God and knowing how to do both at the same time is what we're seeking for.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's do some discussion. So the thought questions, let's look at these. So here's one objection. So there's plenty of objections, but humans being sinful, they're unable to discern with accuracy what is just and right. Basically that we're not really able to do this because of our sinful nature, because we are human. It'd be better for us not to fight, because we don't think it's possible to have just or righteous motivations. What are some? Agree or disagree? I mean, truth there. How would you respond to that?
Well, if we applied this to every situation in life, we wouldn't be able to make any decisions.
Yeah. There's not really everything's corrupted, right? That's the depravity. Mm-hmm.
But it's a worthwhile thing to consider as we make a really big decision.
Mm-hmm.
The gravity of it. This is a good thing to think about as we make decisions. I want to affirm that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think too. There's definitely a point where you're addressing the need for God in all things. It's only walking by the Spirit that we're able to, you know, obey God at all in any area. So especially in this area.
Is it maybe a matter of patience too, where you're not sure sometimes if there's a potential threat, but you're not sure? Patience can just decide that sometimes one way or the other, if it grows or if it
mm-hmm.
doesn't.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's a little bit related to like this. The second question is about this. Why is it in many circles we have a presumption against force as opposed to a presumption against injustice, in the sense that we tend to always want to err on the side of not going to war versus this is unjust. We need to go to war. We need to go to war. I mean, why do you think, what's kind of some reasoning behind that? Do you think that's accurate, and why do you think so?
Say that one more time.
So the question is, you know, if we're debating whether or not we ought to engage in war,
mm-hmm.
There tends to be probably a presumption against it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's not go to war
mm-hmm.
unless, you know, we're absolutely certain. Instead of the presumption being if there's an injustice, we ought to go to war. We ought to go to war unless there's a good reason not to.
Yeah.
There's a part of that. The thing of injustice in other countries is a political question of, is it the role of one nation to address the injustices of another nation?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's really been addressed or not, and how we go to war. But that's not a clear right or wrong
mm-hmm.
in terms of as a political philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Does any nation, are they responsible for the injustice in another? Do they have to protect?
Yeah.
Another nation,
yeah.
They sacrifice their own people to do that, or does a government exist to protect its own country and
mm-hmm.
not other countries?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's a right or wrong. It's,
no.
It's a bigger question I think Christians can disagree about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. If we think about like other areas of authority, like are there times when you kind of intervene? So as parents, you know, you're given authority over your kids, and generally you let other parents parent the way they want. And there may be times where the abuses of a parent are severe enough that you would want to step in and protect those children, or same thing, elders and believers. Is how do you make that judgment call? When is there something that's severe enough that you feel a responsibility to step in?
Yeah, one example of that is the genocide of the Tutsis in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where basically the dominant tribe rose up and was slaughtering all the Tutsis with machetes. And
yeah.
Close to a million people died. And there was a UN presence there, but there was no military intervention to stop it. And I think one of the great questions is, should the West have intervened
mm-hmm.
to stop a genocide from happening, or is that just a quote-unquote civil war where you let people
yeah.
work it out?
Yeah. Yeah. Not an easy question. I think it's sometimes hard to, because a lot of times we feel like we are, and in truth, a lot of times we're at this level where we're not really sure if we have any role or responsibility at all. Where, you know, I'm not making these military decisions, I'm not making this policy. And sometimes the challenge is remembering that, you know, the government is made up of citizens. And so sometimes if you're serving in any sense in public office or in government jobs, or like we talked about last time, enlisting or joining the military, then you can at some point mm-hmm. become more and more involved in those decisions. And so sometimes it's more, you know, at the very, very base level, do you support the actions of your country? How do you pray? Mm-hmm. How do you encourage? How do you counsel the people, you know, your sons and daughters about whether or not they should be involved in this war or not, or how they should do it justly? And so sometimes we're talking about like the big decisions, you know, should we drop the bomb or not?
Mm-hmm.
But there's all this part where, as a nation and as people and as citizens and as believers, how do you participate
mm-hmm.
and, you know, render to Caesar those things that are Caesar's? And each country has its own Caesar and system of government that some require you to serve in the military, some give you the option of whether or not you
mm-hmm.
you want to enlist.
I can't say this is, like, for certain an answer, but
yeah.
I would suspect it has something to do with the responsibility assigned to activity versus the responsibility assigned to passivity. At the very least in America, you have the right to intervene if you see a crime going on, but you do not have the obligation to do so.
Mm-hmm.
That might be different in Europe, where they actually have different laws, where if you see somebody who's like in danger, for example, you are legally obligated to help them.
Mm.
That there's not that rule in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I think it's like the Good Samaritan law or something like that.
Yeah.
But I think when you decide to engage and actively do something, it feels at the very least like there's a whole other level of responsibility
mm-hmm.
that you bear
mm-hmm.
as opposed to allowing something to happen.
Yeah, and there's kind of that overlap too, where you have the mandated reporting type deal, where there are some people where you know, there's a case where legally you are obligated to, you know, that you see children, they have signs of abuse, then yeah, you punishable if you don't report it. So you are required to get involved.
There's a danger of being overconfident what war can actually accomplish as well. So the complexity of human sinfulness and brokenness and
mm-hmm.
desires. I was thinking, reading of James, why do you have quarrels?
Mm-hmm.
I think that war within you, your
mm-hmm.
desires. A gun can only solve a few problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking of a more recent, the one that Dave mentioned, but more recently in Haiti, right now,
yeah.
you have gangs that have taken over the entire country. And I was just with my our former team leader there, we had to pull out.
Mm-hmm.
And you can send the U.S. military, but you're not going to fix their problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might stop something temporarily,
mm-hmm.
but war can't actually deal with the underlying issues in their worldview,
mm-hmm.
their structures, their systems.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to be really realistic about what can actually be accomplished. And that, at times, will cause us to not send in the military because
mm-hmm.
it'll just we'll have to do it again a few years later.
Yeah, or I think we had a lot of those talks too, like in Middle East conflicts where we go in and there's like no government, right? And you're like, well, we want to establish democracy and we're trying, and it's like you get involved and how do you back out without just creating, you know, fertile ground for it to just start all over again.
When you have fingers in everybody's pies and you take out your fingers, sometimes the pies collapse.
Yeah. I think too, there's just a sense when I think about this, the presumption against force, I do think that it's, there's a part of me at least that, just in my flesh, that I don't like to talk about and preach about hell and God's judgment against sin. And in Romans 13, there's this idea since that God does institute governments to avenge wrath on the evildoer. And there's just a human, I don't know if it's the flesh, but kind of a reluctance to think about God's way of judging us for sin. And sometimes that's through, you know, hell. Sometimes it's, you know, through earthly judgment and through the government, through punishment. We talked about capital punishment. And then so there is a sense too where God's justice is a difficult thing to put our mind around and to see the goodness and the holiness there. It's just difficult. I think there's a challenge there. I think we kind of talked about this a little bit in question E, right? Since war is open to moral abuse, Christians should not participate. So what's your view? I mean, can we hold the view that war, sometimes God uses war, it's possible to have just war, but Christians ought not to participate? I mean, how would you react to, respond to that kind of position? Are there good things about that position? Are there times when you'd hold that, times when you'd say no?
How would you describe moral abuse in the conflict?
Well, you know, just saying that in war, oftentimes all of these or some of these are not being met. So it's not a just war because maybe we have a just cause, we have just intent, but we haven't you know, sought out all of their means. We didn't really declare war. We were seeking unconditional surrender. There's all these unjust, immoral parts of the war. So we need to stay completely out of it. Are there times when we would want to hold that or not?
Well, I think, I mean, let's say we go back 1,000 years and we're living in Europe and a Mongol horde is at the gates of our city and they want to basically rape all the women and kill all our children. For the men to sit out, Christians to sit out and just say this is somebody else's job to protect, mm-hmm. you know, in a very just war context seems almost cheap. Mm-hmm. And like an abdication of the responsibility I think the Lord has given to men, you know, to lay down their lives for others. And often that is in the sense of trying to defend the innocent from, let's say, an invasion. It gets more complicated, obviously, as war and the motivations for war are more complicated. But but you know, the Lord also prescribed serving in war for Israel, and they clearly that was a righteous reason to do so.
Other thoughts? Yeah, Jason.
Yeah, something that kind of comes to my mind is also that we as the church are a moral compass within society. Mm-hmm. We convict, we you know, we share the gospel, and we let people know what is sin. So you also take that context and then you put that within the conflict, and we can have a positive outcome on how things are handled or what is done or what is not done. Mm-hmm. So I think there is an argument to be said of that.
Just within government today, wouldn't it be nice if we had some Christians
Yeah, and you know, your point about not just the military but the government, it does, it just brings up that this idea that we've got to remember that as we are to be immersed in the world, we're surrounded by the lost, and that can be in almost every avenue, and if every one of those avenues has its challenges of how do you preach the gospel and, you know, live a holy life in the context of an ungodly world. So that could be a teacher in a public school, right? Or it could be whatever your job is. Most people that have a job outside of ministry are surrounded by ungodly people, and you can often serve as a, in a sense, a sanctifying agent in that area where people act differently around you. Again, just it's just in film, but I think about in, there's a scene in Saving Private Ryan where they capture a prisoner, they're ready to just execute him, and you know, the commanding officer talks them, you know, through, this isn't right, this isn't just, they kind of have that. So without a moral voice there, in one sense you could wonder, are any of these things, would any of these things be even considered if there wasn't a moral presence or a...
Yeah, I mean, if as believers our litmus test on whether we participate in something or not is whether it's open to moral abuse or not, we probably wouldn't participate in anything, because everything is arguably open to moral abuse, which is probably a better argument of why we should be participating.
Yeah, but it makes it a challenge, right? Because you're, how do you, I think that's the question. And I think we have some examples. Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's more a matter of, like, is it more likely for moral abuse to happen as opposed to, like, anything. Anything is open to moral abuse, think about it. But war, it's more, like, it may be more frequent and it may be more likely. So maybe that's why many Christians may say this.
Yeah.
There's life at stake.
Yeah, there's life at stake. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a sense in which the way in which you participate can kind of have a variety of influences. Like, you maybe you do join, and you could be like we've talked about, you could be the Desmond Dawes, and your conviction is, I'm going to join this war, but I'm going to be a medic and I'm not going to take life personally. You could be what's the other guy I was thinking about,
Sergeant York,
that's the guy. Yeah, where he's convicted that, okay, I will participate in one way or the other. But there's also times where you may need to suffer the consequences of your commanding officer commands you to do something that's unjust, and you're, by conviction, you need to disobey that, because there are times where we need to disobey our government or our parents or whatever if they're calling us to sin, which is deliberate. So at what point do we separate ourselves completely, and at what point are we somewhat engaged in a way where we're talking through and conflicting?
Scott, how do you apply the principle of not being unequally yoked to non-believers in this discussion?
Well, my first question is that, you know, when you think about the context of marriage and it's, you can make a fairly clear judgment about an individual, whether they're a believer or an unbeliever. And so I think when you apply that, say, for an individual and an organization, or maybe a government or a military, you're asking a question between an individual and a group that's composed oftentimes of a blend of believers and unbelievers. And so I think it would be pretty difficult to say that the American government or the American military is, that you're completely, I think the imagery there was darkness and light, right? What fellowship does we have with darkness and light? And so I would think that there is a blend of those things. And so part of me would say that if you are going to join yourself, say you want to work for the government or you want to join the military, there's a certain soberness that you have, knowing that you may be seeking to align yourselves with the portions of those that you believe are right and just, but you're going to encounter those things as a part of that that are you're not going to be aligned with. And so you have to go into it knowing that there's a very good likelihood that you will, things will not be easy or not go well with you. And so in a small way, I know as a teacher that there might be philosophies that my superintendent or my principal or my school district adopts that I won't be able to be aligned with. And I'm ready to be obedient to God and be disobedient to them if that comes to place, and I'm okay with getting fired or being disciplined. But I kind of go into it believing that, okay, there's a calling and a purpose for me in this limited way where I'm trying to serve God in this area. And whatever the consequences may be, I think about how Daniel and his friends, God called them to seek the good of that nation. But there were clearly times where they had to say, no, we're not going to fall down and worship at this idol. And we think God will save us. He can save us from this furnace, but if he doesn't, we're going to go into the furnace. And I think that's kind of the philosophy we almost have to have if we're going into participate in a lot of areas, but especially in the military, is that there will be some, it's magnified in this case of war, like we were saying just a second ago. The consequences when you do or don't could be your life or someone else's life, but the principle is still the same, is that in almost every area of our lives and our work, God's calling us to serve him in a particular way for the good of our neighbor, and there will be times when we're at conflict with those who want to do so non-godly.
So another question, as you think about a believer participating in just war, and some of these criterion, like you maybe think are getting broken, but say like if you're an infantryman, you don't know all the details, right? And so like formal declaration or last resort,
right.
You don't know a lot of those things. And so you make the call to disobey, and then, well, it turns out they did know, or that was the last resort, and they turn around and kill your brothers in war. I guess, I don't know, like just the deciding factor of all these criterion, I don't know how much liberty we have in war to make some of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, do you trust the people above you? If not, like, you probably shouldn't be there. Because at some point, you got to say, yes, sir.
Yeah.
And go do what you're told. Otherwise, you're, I mean, the goal of peace, well, then you just got your brothers killed. I mean, that's, if you don't obey and perform an act that you're asked to go do, go in this village and kill these people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you don't do that, they turn around and you know, sent bombs your way and killed all your brothers. So I just saw some of those things of like this just war criterion. I don't know. It's I don't think it's as cut and dry as as what it looks like.
Yeah, and I think you bring up an important fact that a lot of the things we're talking about, again, and we maybe mentioned it in the last hand, these are a lot of things that you would really deal with beforehand and not in the midst.
Yeah.
It's to kind of inform and shape our conscience. But in the midst of it, oftentimes it's God has gifted you with a conscience. And so at the base level, it's you don't go against the way what your conscience is telling you to do. And that's a huge gift that God's given us that we shouldn't underestimate. Many times you will know and you'll feel convicted as a believer what you ought to do or what you ought not to do. And a lot of this kind of not just searching the scriptures, but also searching, like you said, if we're going to war, why are we going? What are we doing? Why are we?
Yeah.
Like that can help inform and shape like what your conscience is.
Yeah, and I think the U.S. military has a mechanism for if war crimes are being committed, the expectation is that you don't submit to your commanding officer, like with the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, where they basically tortured and killed a bunch of civilians. You know, there was justice that was brought to the men who perpetrated that, and the expectation was the soldiers don't engage in that. So I think a lot of it depends on who is your military, and if the military holds high ideals holds itself accountable to the Geneva Convention, mm-hmm. recognizes such a thing as war crimes, tells the soldiers that you have a higher obligation. I mean, if some of those things are in place, I think it's a lot easier to be, to join that kind of military versus mm-hmm. a military that does whatever it takes to win and is willing to do war crimes and these other things to accomplish their objective.
But with all due respect, Guantanamo Bay, or operations where you have, like, the American government is supposedly pro justice and pro these things, and on some level it's true that they are held accountable. I don't want to discredit that, but they're only held accountable insofar as they are not caught committing those.
But if you're a whistleblower and you draw attention to like the Abu Ghraib prison or something like that, there's a mechanism for exoneration for people who do the right thing.
Yeah, when it comes to warfare and war crimes, there is a tremendous aspect where as believers, we can kind of identify with the psalmist that there's this constant cry throughout, you know, the life under the curse for justice. And we see injustice at all levels. We see it outside the government. We see it inside the government. And so as believers, you have this place where we're called to cry out and seek God's justice, and through his means and through his methods that he's instituted, both now, temporary, and then ultimate justice. And so oftentimes we're disappointed because justice seems to come slower than we would like, especially when we're the ones that are wronged, when we see the injustice happening to those that we love. We're crying out for justice, but at the same time, we know that, you know, God promises that he's not slow, but he's patient, seeking that all that would come to repentance that he would call. And so there's this time where we're living with limited amounts of God's patient justice, protecting those that are being persecuted and those who are being harmed. And we have to wait for his ultimate justice in a sense that kind of creates a longing for a time when warfare will be ended at the end.
I think it's also easy to, in the context of American military, even to focus on some of the really like dark stains in our history. Whereas, mm-hmm. Like Dave said, that there are the things in place to deal with those, and just because somebody gets away with them doesn't mean that they're not there and active and what is mm-hmm. actually normal. And I mean, you talk to a lot of military guys that go overseas and they see horrible things, but the way that on the most times American military is viewed very positively, and so it's just like I said, it's easy to almost mm-hmm. overcompensate on our dark stains, and mm-hmm. you just compare what the American military will do overseas trying to stop what mm-hmm. another country is, just ridiculous, heinous things that are out in the open and well known. There's a lot more, it's easier to understand the just aspect of being there.
Yeah, and I guess kind of in conclusion, I mean, what we've seen is that it's very, very difficult to and the goal is not to justify war. I think the point of the message is that in this world, under the cursed world, where evil is a part of this world, we have to stop short of saying all war is always wrong by all people, that Christians can never be involved in any form, in any fashion. And the difficult part, the challenging part, is to seek out what way, if any, what way can we and should we be involved in not just civil life, but in war, and how can we be praying, how can we be counseling, and even in those rare circumstances, can I and should I participate in some form or fashion? Yeah, Floyd.
Yeah, I think the lowest common denominator, having two son-in-laws still in the service and having been multiply employed, is they take care of each other. That's it. Mm-hmm. You do what you have to do to take care of the platoon you're in. You have to do what you have to do to take care of the company you're in. To get some direction from Langley or the bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's determining how to how to live and make those choices, right? That's a, it's a well, all boils down to that. So, yeah.
I was just going to kind of piggyback off of that and some of the other things that's been said. Like there is a pragmatic element to this. Effect. Even if all of these just work criteria aren't met, I think one of the things that has to be taken into consideration is like, okay, even though the situation might not be perfect, what's going to happen if we go to war? What's going to happen if we don't intervene? Those kinds of things. What's going to happen to my people that I love? What's going to happen mm-hmm. to the military? What's going to happen to the military? What's going to happen?
You're choosing between horrible options.
Yeah, so even though it might not be a perfect situation.
It's like voting.
It's like,
sorry.
Yeah. So I just think that's another thing that gets down to it.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to wrap this up. What's next? Do we know what's next?
The government. So I think Jason.
Jason's going to delve even deeper into the government and the state. So let me pray for us. Lord, I just thank you for. Just as Paul often rejoiced in how unsearchable is your wisdom and your knowledge and how deep the depths of it. And we're so thankful that you are the one who reigns over the world, that you hold the nations in your hand. And you put people in authority and you remove them. You establish governments and you destroy them. You establish nations and you destroy them. And as believers, we can feel so small in how we relate to such large decisions. And so we just bring our hearts and minds just to you and to your word and pray that as we interact daily, reading the newspaper or watching the news or talking with those who may or may not be involved in the government or military, just give us great wisdom and help us to know and trust that you are God who is in control of all things. That you have instituted the government as a part of your plan, and that we can trust never to avenge ourselves, but to leave it to you and to the means that you've established. I just thank you for the discussion we've had. I pray that it would be enriched and that you continue to help us grow through continued study and conversations as we think more deeply about these things. In your name, amen.